Ukraine's truce falls apart. Today, Thursday, February 20th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman. Running battles continue in the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. One former resident remembers the old clock atop a building in Independence Square.
It's like Big Ben in London or a clock in Times Square in New York City. And that clock is silent now. It's kind of frozen in time. And I think that's a nice metaphor to describe what's going on inside the country. It's frozen in time.
And we remember the life and work of Canadian writer Mavis Gallant. This writer says Gallant had her reasons for leaving home in the 1950s.
This feeling of you're a woman, you're not supposed to speak out, you're supposed to marry and have children. And she felt that's part of why she felt that she had to move to Paris.
Plus Siberia, it's not all cold desolation and gulags. No, really. I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. That truce in Ukraine turned out to be very short-lived. The streets of the capital, Kiev, have erupted again. Anti-government protesters fought security forces today. Government snipers fired on protesters. Protesters threw firebombs. Dozens of people are reported dead and many more injured. This Kiev resident lives near Independence Square, the epicenter of the violence.
And I was about to leave for the office at around 10:30 a.m. and I just seen the reports about people being assassinated by snipers. And then I saw the pictures of the confirmed dead people. It's getting very dangerous now walking the street.
So how did things in Ukraine escalate so quickly in the past few days?
I think they escalated because of the inability of the government to address those demands that were initially very, very modest, demands of closer relations with the European Union rather than going back to Russia as the old partner from Soviet times.
Alexei Solohubenko is a Ukraine analyst with the BBC in London. He says the downward spiral began last November after clashes broke out in Kiev.
Protesters were radicalized, troops were radicalized, riot police were radicalized, and the government was still absolutely unable to find a meaningful compromise or to engage in discussions with the opposition.
What about the political opposition in Ukraine? How important are they or how linked are they to the protesters and the whole mess playing out in the streets right now?
Yeah, I think the mess in the streets is basically not the creation of the opposition. It's a self-styled opposition in many ways. What I mean by that is that the opposition represents political parties in Kiev, but it doesn't necessarily represent everybody who is coming out into the streets to protest. Some of them were radicalized groups of young people throwing stones, petrol bombs and the rest of it, but others were not. And I think it's important to stress that the bulk of those who oppose this government or President Yanukovych are peaceful citizens like you and me, and their demands are rather modest. Early elections, for example. They don't want the armed overthrow of the regime.
What's happening outside of Kiev? I know we've heard over and over again how the eastern part of Ukraine tends to be more pro-Russian, the western half of the country more pro-Western Europe. What's going on out there?
In eastern Ukraine, the stronghold of President Yanukovych, there are bellicose calls from the mayor of Kharkiv, for instance, which is the second largest city in Ukraine. He said today that protesters are not peaceful at all and must be physically eliminated. In the Crimea, always a very awkward and difficult area in Ukraine because it was handed over 60 years ago to Ukraine from Russia by Nikita Khrushchev. So in that area, there's open discussion about secession. So the longer this crisis continues in the capital, the more volatile the whole provincial setup of Ukraine becomes and the more dangerous it is for this very, very young country, which is just 22 years old, with vibrant but fairly fragile democracy.
Alexei, what's the way out of this crisis for Ukraine?
Well, it's hard to say. I think the first thing that needs to be done is for the violence to stop. And for that, the president must give the order to its troops to stop firing live munitions, live bullets, and to withdraw the troops from the streets of Ukrainian cities. Who will be able to make that order? The president should. Will he? It's not clear. But also it's not clear whether he will be heard, whether he will be listened to. So I'm afraid now the situation is extremely volatile and unpredictable. And there isn't a simple or an optimistic answer. So I suspect that violence and more deaths will be reported in the next couple of days.
And finally, Alexei, what is this crisis? How has it affected you personally? You grew up in Ukraine.
Well, obviously, you know, I know all the places where, which are now the battlefields. You saw those famous barricades next to the Kiev football stadium with the fires and the burning and the shooting and everything else. This is, you know, I walked down that street for years because I was playing tennis just next door. So it's all kind of very strange and very, very familiar. But there's one image that for me is very, very important. You know, one of the burnt out buildings on Independence Square, on top of it, there was a city clock. It's like Big Ben in London or a clock in Times Square in New York City. And that clock is silent now. It's kind of frozen in time. And I think that's a nice metaphor to describe what's going on inside the country. It's frozen in time. And hopefully it will be restarted and there'll be some kind of movement. But at this stage, the clock is idle.
The BBC's Alexei Soloubenko. Thanks so much, Alexei.
Thank you.
We also wanted to find out how Russians are reacting to events in Ukraine. So we called up Julia Yaffe, senior editor with The New Republic. We caught up with her in Sochi, where she's covering the Olympics. Unlike many of her colleagues, she's not hopping on a plane for Kiev today, but she is watching Russian state media and how it's spinning the violence in Ukraine.
Mostly on Russian TV, you're seeing reports that this is a band of radicals, of right-wing fascist radicals, who are trying to stage a violent coup, trying to overthrow a legitimate, democratically elected government with peaceful citizens stuck in between and held hostage by the radicals. The only casualties we hear about are policemen and special forces officers, very little about the civilians, some of them armed civilians who have been killed. And Russian leaders are very much sticking to the line that this is a coup going on and that the Ukrainian government has every right to use force to protect the law enforcement agencies, not the citizens, but the law enforcement agencies.
So it's very much a kind of law and order view. What are Russia's interests in Ukraine today?
They're mostly geopolitical and economic. Very famously, Vladimir Putin is said to have said to George W. Bush back in 2008 that Ukraine is not a real country. He sees the Ukraine very much as an extension of Russia, as basically a province of Russia that, by an accident of history, has its own borders and its own government and its own foreign policy. It's even called Little Russia or Minor Russia by people in some circles here. You know, there's a geopolitical component to it about, you know, not letting NATO and Europe expand to Russia's doorstep. But it also goes deeper than that. It's about protecting Slavic brethren, protecting a brother nation, not letting them fall under the sway of Europe.
What are Putin's options regarding Ukraine? I mean, what can he realistically do to influence the outcome there in his favor?
He can do a lot. He's doing a lot now. He's giving them lots of money, billions of dollars, and Ukraine really needs that money. It's not doing that well economically.
But what about now, this actual crisis? What can he do to influence the outcome of the bloodshed and violence going on in the square?
I think he can give Yanukovych the sense that he's behind him. And, you know, he can always send reinforcements, provide equipment, training. But I think mostly it's the money and the political support, which I think goes a long way with Yanukovych.
Is there any talk? I mean, you mentioned yourself of the Russian media pushing this, you know, our brethren in the Ukraine and pushing those historic ties. Is there any talk of Russia intervening directly to restore order or protect ethnic Russians?
People are kind of hinting at it obliquely, and, you know, there's allusions to it, and people keep waiting for the headline, for the news to flash across the wire that, you know, that the Russians are going to intervene. But so far, hasn't really been any talk of this. I doubt Russia wants to do this, but, you know, as we've seen in Georgia, when it comes to Russia's near abroad in its backyard, it's not loath to put its money where its mouth is or its soldiers where its mouth is.
Julia Yaffe is a senior editor with The New Republic. She's been speaking to us from Sochi. Thanks so much, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to stay in Russia now, but in a part that hasn't been in the headlines lately. 2013, though, was a big year for Siberia, at least here in America. Here's writer Alina Simone.
First, there was the Chelyabinsk meteor, which rained down on our screens courtesy of the Russian fetish for dashboard cams. Then there was the summer debut of NBC's Siberia, a thriller about a reality show set in the remote territory of the Tunguska River. The 16 contestants quickly found themselves at the mercy of the elements, stalked by paranormal forces. Cue the shaky cam.
What is that?
The show plays off Siberia's entrenched history as a spooky place where bad things happen to good people. It continues to have something of a PR problem. For 6 years, I worked on and off in Siberia, and I could never just tell my American friends where I was going without hearing 5 minutes of jokes about ice and gulags. My friend Sarah Lindemann Komarova moved to Novosibirsk from New York in 1991 for a four-month teaching job and ended up going native. Now, when people in the U.S. meet her for the first time, they often think she's using the word Siberia as a metaphor.
I said, I live in Siberia. And he said, you mean really? Because he thought I meant Iowa or something. He assumed that I was referring to the Midwest.
Novosibirsk is Russia's third largest city, and it's a cosmopolitan place. The airport there had great coffee before most of Russia. And last month, the mayor approved the first plaque to honor a female Russian punk singer in the country. Not a member of Pussy Riot, but Yanka Diaghileva, a cult hero who died in 1991.
I mean, it was sort of amazing when I started to really think about the things that people don't know, what happened in Siberia. They think it's prisons and bears, but the first particle accelerator was here. Perestroika was born here. The environmental movement, modern environmental, started here. Not only did it start here, but this was where there was success.
Sarah's talking about Russia's environmental movement. So why has Siberia become an incubator for so much innovation?
I think partially because the people here are used to coping with a lot of things and facing constraints that force you to be creative and think of new things. You're more on the edge. And that's what makes it exciting and an interesting place to be, because it's a more honest place, I think.
And as for the weather, here's a bombshell. Siberia isn't really that cold, at least in the south, where 90% of Siberians live. The average annual temperature in Novosibirsk is only a few degrees colder than parts of Maine, Minnesota, and Colorado. And a lot of people who live there consider the environment a big plus.
That's what I think what makes Siberia really special is that connection to nature. That isn't all about because it's freezing all the time, because it isn't. Where I live, it's pretty cold, like a few days a year where it is miserably cold. But the rest of it is like living in this fairy tale land.
The conversations I had with friends before leaving for Siberia always ended in giant air quotes. Have fun in Siberia, they'd say. And I wanted to tell them I will. I've seen amazing things there, from mummified Buddhist llamas to Chippendale-style strip shows. Once, while staying at a hotel in Akademgorodok, I was awoken by the sound of pounding techno to discover the snowy parking lot full of dancers throwing flaming batons up in the air. The weird flotsam of pop culture is ever-present, even in Siberia, where the encroachment of IKEA, Miley Cyrus, and bad American pizza is a much bigger threat than bears, meteors, even paranormal stalkers. For The World, this is Alina Simone in New York.
If you want to catch a glimpse of the real Siberia without buying a plane ticket, check out the book Siberia in the Eyes of Russian Photographers. The photos are amazing. We have a slideshow from the book at PRI.org. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. This next story is about the man in charge of guarding Israel's most sensitive documents. Historian Yaakov Lozowick was raised in Chicago. A couple of years ago, he took over as the head of Israel's state archives. Among the millions of papers in those archives are Israeli state secrets. But the new state archivist is on a mission to declassify more documents than ever before. Reporter Daniel Estrin met him in the archives storage facility in Jerusalem.
This is Jerusalem's industrial zone, a jumble of steakhouses and car dealerships and furniture showrooms, and one large fenced-in building with millions of pieces of paper. It's the Israel State Archives storage facility. The location is kept under wraps. State Archivist Yaakov Lozowick says that's in order to protect what's inside.
So although it's here, and it's a very big building, and a lot of people have walked by it, there's nothing to advertise what it is.
Shall we walk in?
Yep, let's go in. We are now inside the storage facility. As you can see, there are row upon row upon row, room upon room upon room, floor upon floor, many hundreds of millions of records, paper records in this building. What's in here is basically irreplaceable.
Lozowick brought me to an inner chamber to check out some of the highlights of the archive.
This is the kind of obvious thing that you would think that we have, but it's cool to see it. This is the peace agreement between Israel and Egypt.
Wow.
It's a thick, sort of book. It's leather, gold embossed, because this is a very special document. And it's signed for the government of the Arab Republic of Egypt by Anwar Sadat, for the government of Israel by Menachem Begin, witnessed by Jimmy Carter.
So this is a thick peace agreement. I mean, if anyone ever wanted to know what a peace agreement looks like, this is it.
This is what the peace agreement looks like, yes.
There are also pieces from the darker periods of Israeli history. Lozowick showed me objects from the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin by Yigal Amir, an Israeli extremist.
This is the pistol with which Yigal Amir shot Yitzhak Rabin. And we
May
have
I touch
here...
Him?
Yes, you can.
Wow.
I'm sorry to say that this gun in my hand feels cold and it almost feels fake.
It's not fake. I assure you it's not fake.
I mean, has it ever gone on display?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
The gun that changed the course of Israeli history has never been on display? I mean, at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., you can check out famous artifacts from modern American history. Lincoln's top hat, Dorothy's ruby red slippers. But there's no Israeli equivalent where you can see iconic objects from Israel's modern history.
You're used to going through papers, and I mean, it's one thing to have a document reading about the assassination. It's another thing to have in your hand the cold gun. I mean, what does that feel like?
On a personal level, that doesn't really speak to me. It's a gun. It's a gun which did a horrible deed once upon a time, but it wasn't the gun that did it. It was the man holding it. It doesn't, I mean, some people get shudders down their back, I suppose. I don't.
What does move Lozowick are the millions of documents with untold stories about Israel's history, documents just waiting to be dusted off for the world to see. It's what he does best, combing through millions of pieces of data. In 2004, as chief archivist at Israel's Holocaust Museum, he helped launch an online database of Holocaust victims' names. It was an unprecedented project. For his new job, Lozowick has been helped by some adjustments Israel recently made in its official secrets laws. While it lengthened the time defense-related documents can be kept under wraps, it shortened the amount of time non-security-related papers could be kept secret. And so Lozowick is working to declassify as much as he can.
The motivation to do that is that we feel that the historical documentation of the State of Israel is relevant for contemporary discussions. Large percentages of what is written and said and reported about the State of Israel is inaccurate at best. A lot of the documentation that we have could have been declassified, but hasn't been because we have this gigantic backlog.
Can you quantify how much stuff do you have that could be declassified that isn't?
30 or 40% of what we have. 150 million pages.
That's enormous. So 30 to 40% of information that the public today could know, they don't know.
That's right.
Here's one thing we now know. Israel's State Archives recently published a secret document that in 1962, the Mossad spy agency gave paramilitary training to a young Nelson Mandela. It also published documents showing Israel's sympathy for the anti-apartheid struggle. Some have speculated the release of those documents was aimed at softening criticism for Israel's close ties with the apartheid regime. And when it comes to sensitive moments in Israel's history, some researchers have charged that Israeli archives have reclassified documents that were once declassified. Lozowick denies that his job is damage control.
We're not trying to conceal things. The more we can open, the better. And the consideration of it will make the State of Israel look good or not is not a consideration for us, because that's not relevant in a democracy.
The Israel State Archives has an English-language blog showing all kinds of documents. You can read the once-top-secret cabinet deliberations about the Sabra and Shatila massacre of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. And you can also see former Prime Minister Golda Meir's personal recipe for chicken soup with matzo balls. For the record, that was never classified. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Back to Ukraine for a minute now, or actually to Sochi, where members of the Ukrainian team at the Winter Olympics have no doubt been watching events back home with great concern. One of them is 24-year-old skier Bogdana Matsatska. In fact, Matsatska is so concerned that she's decided to pull out of the Olympics early and fly home.
It's a difficult situation in Ukraine. It's not difficult, it's a crazy situation when people died and they are my friends, my family, and I cannot race in this condition, this situation.
Bogdana was scheduled to compete tomorrow in the women's slalom. It's her favorite event, but she decided to give it up.
It's like a protest. The first rule of Olympic Games is the peace, and now our president just decided to do this really bad things to citizens of my country, and I cannot have good race in this situation.
Matsatska says she plans to join the street protests as soon as she gets back to Kiev. She also wore a black armband during the games to commemorate those who've been killed in the protests. But even as she heads home, she says she understands why some of her compatriots have not abandoned the games.
Everybody have their mind, and my choice is not racing.
Matsatska says she's worried about her country. She wishes that President Yanukovych would step aside and let a more caring leader take over. She says she wants to see a strong, independent Ukraine, but also one that she says is on the Europe side. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, oh, the beauty of a winning TV formula in South Korea.
You'll always have the really rich, sort of aloof male lead. And then you'll have the poor girl with a heart of gold.
It's called K-drama, and it's got fans right here in the U.S. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. 3 years ago, journalists poured into Egypt to cover the uprising there. It seemed to be the start of a new Egypt. But now that Egypt seems to have reverted to the old one, a place where journalists can't operate freely. Peter Gresta, Mohamed Fahmy, and Bahr Mohamed are well aware of that. The three Al Jazeera English reporters have been in Egyptian custody for more than 50 days. Now. Earlier today, they made an appearance in an Egyptian courtroom. Ruth Pollard is a journalist for the Sydney Morning Herald. She was at today's court proceedings. And Ruth, what was the scene like in the courtroom?
It was pretty extraordinary. Egyptian court cases are always quite wild to witness. So what we saw today was the three Al Jazeera journalists, along with five other co-defendants who they didn't even know, dressed in white prison jumpsuits, being held in these enormous black cages off to the side of the courtroom. During the proceedings, there was very little back and forth between the defendants and the judge or the prosecution. But during the break, we were able to shout to them into their cages, and they were able to shout back to us.
And what did they say?
They said that the international campaign of support that has been rolling out around the world for the journalists had resulted in much better conditions and protections for them inside the prison, and they called on people to continue that support and to escalate that support. They, in particular, Peter Gresta and Mohamed Fahmy, called on the Australian and Canadian governments to speak out about their plight. They described their prison conditions as physically okay, but psychologically unbearable.
Ruth, what are they charged with?
Essentially, they're charged with fabricating false news, manipulating footage in order to deliberately tarnish Egypt's reputation internationally.
So that's basically a fancy way of saying we didn't like what you reported. Is that what they're after? Is that what they're trying to get at?
From everything that we've viewed of the Al Jazeera English journalists' work in Egypt for the last few months, and indeed since they've been operating in Egypt, they have simply been going about their job as any journalists would, interviewing people from both sides of the story, and that includes people from the Muslim Brotherhood, as well as the interim-backed government, as well as other political parties and opposition voices in Egypt at the moment. But because the Brotherhood has fallen so far from the favour of the Egyptian people, and of course since December 25 the government has designated them a terrorist organisation, the very idea of interviewing the Brotherhood or giving voice to opposition parties within Egypt is seen as criticising the Egyptian government in a way that's completely unacceptable.
Did they go into any details about what their conditions were like before the international outcry and then after? What specifically changed?
Well, Peter Grester was held in the Tora prison, which is a high security prison complex in Cairo. The Egyptian-Canadian journalist Mohamed Fahmy and his Egyptian colleague Baher Mohamed were held in this really high security prison complex, which is known as Scorpion, which is reserved for people on, you know, high level terrorism charges. And they were held in absolutely horrific conditions. They, you know, were sleeping on cold concrete floors. Mohamed Fahmy has a very badly injured shoulder, which is broken. And he received no medical treatment or painkillers for that. Mohamed and Baher were transferred into the Tora prison, and they're now housed with Peter Grester in that prison. But since then, they've been confined to their cells for 23 hours a day. They're only allowed out for 1 hour a day. They're allowed no reading material or writing material in there, and they don't get to see sunlight.
What's the next step in this case?
Well, they've been remanded in custody, I guess, essentially. No bail was granted, and the next hearing is scheduled for March 5. They requested today, continually, both through their lawyers and also during the court breaks when they were trying to talk to us, for them to be given access to the material that forms the case against them, because as yet they've seen no evidence presented that they in any way manipulated footage or tarnished Egypt's reputation in any way by doing the balanced and fair reporting job that they had done in Egypt, covering what is a very tense and complex political situation here.
Ruth Pollard reports for the Sydney Morning Herald. We've been speaking to her from Cairo. Thanks, Ruth.
Thank you very much.
And now to another part of the world where journalists face dangers, Brazil. 2 weeks ago, photojournalist Santiago Andrade died while covering a protest in Rio de Janeiro. It happened just outside the central train station. Demonstrators had converged on the building to protest a fare increase. Those kinds of protests have broken out over the past year as Brazil prepares to host the World Cup this summer. The BBC's Weir Davis was at the demonstration where Andrade was killed, and he describes what happened.
I saw quite clearly with my own eyes, as we were between the protesters and the police, what was a flare or a very large firework lying on the ground. And I was about to shout out because I saw this thing alight, and then suddenly it took off and exploded right behind Santiago Andrade's head. And he fell to the ground immediately, and we were with him in about 4 seconds.
Was this thing that exploded lying on the ground, or was it, did somebody throw it?
I didn't see anybody throw it, but later television pictures seem to show that one of the protesters threw it on the ground. But this was like a large firework or a flare. It was certainly more than your average firework, and it caused an awful lot of damage. I mean, when I reached Santiago, he had very, very bad head wounds, and we did our best to try and save him and get him to hospital. The scene was totally chaotic. Nobody really knew what to do. From a first aid perspective, there was a lot of recriminations going on. The police were standing off. And luckily for myself and my cameraman, Chuck Taman, we've got all of the necessary training and did what we could to try and save him.
It's so sad. I know, Weir, you're no stranger to reporting in hostile environments. How does reporting in Brazil compare to the places you've reported during the Arab Spring, for example?
Yes, it's a good point. I never really expected the same level of intensity when it comes to violence here. Latin America can be a violent place. We've had military coups here in the past. There is social upheaval and a lot of tension on the ground here, but nothing I would have expected to match, of course, what I'd seen in Syria and Tunisia and Libya in particular. And the protests here have been violent, and this is a real problem for the government in Brazil because we've got a World Cup coming up, then we've got the Olympics. There's a general election later this year, and all of these events, you know, could make an unhealthy mix to to bring out more protesters on the streets, and that there is a feeling that, the protests again will get violent, even though it must be said, this is very important, that only a small minority of those protesting ever resort to violence.
And when you say violence, you mentioned that it kind of goes from 0 to 60 very fast. What are we talking about? What are the protesters doing, and how are the authorities responding?
Both sides are to blame. You've got the military police here. It's a militarized police force. And then you've got this hardcore group of anarchist protesters known as the Black Blocs. The Black Blocs, usually towards the end of a protest, when it gets dark, they break off. They attack big institutional buildings like McDonald's or the big banks or political bodies. They're anti-internationalization, and they will try and destroy those buildings. They throw Molotov cocktails. What they were doing at the train station the other day was destroying the ticketing machines. And then you get the response from the military police, which is no attempt at containment. So you had the confined space of a train station, and with hundreds of commuters leaving work, this happened at about 7 o'clock in the evening, and suddenly the police are firing tear gas, they're firing stun grenades. There's no real subtle approach. But equally, of course, they blame the protesters for being bent or committed to destroying the World Cup, to disrupting the World Cup. So both sides here are clearly to blame.
And you've said several times in this interview that you expect these protests to start up again. And is that in anticipation of the World Cup?
I think so. The government, the local government here in Rio, has stuck to these price increases. There's a lot of discontent in Brazil at the amount of money the government has spent on the World Cup to bring these stadiums to Brazil, about $15 billion. And a lot of people don't see any public dividend. They don't see the promised infrastructural benefits, the public transport systems that were meant to come to all of these World Cup venues, along with the stadiums, have mainly been dropped. And it's become a very big public expenditure embarrassment for Brazil, the World Cup. The football, the soccer will be a success. But I do wonder how Brazil as a nation will benefit from the World Cup. And that is one of the reasons we're seeing so many protests.
The BBC's Weir Davis in Rio de Janeiro. Thanks, Weir.
My pleasure.
Maybe you're a Downton Abbey fan, or you've just binge-watched season 2 of House of Cards. It's hard to deny the pull of a primetime soap. Well, South Korea has its own version of TV dramas filled with implausible storylines and romantic twists and turns. And these shows have been popular in Asia for years. But now, thanks to Netflix and other online streaming services, they're gaining a cult-like following here in the U.S., as Akiko Fujita reports.
I have a lot of favorites. There's a lot I really like, but
Joyce Brand browses popular Korean websites searching for her favorite Korean soap operas or K-dramas, according to fans.
Lee Jung-gi.
That's him?
That's him. Well, I think the thing I like best about him is the variety, that he's played everything from King and the Clown.
Brand is 65 years old, from L.A., and not your typical K-drama fan. She admits she didn't know about South Korean TV until one of the shows popped up on her Netflix recommendation list.
I started watching it, and as soon as I saw the subtitles, I thought about turning it off. But then I thought, well, I'll watch it for a few minutes. And within 10 minutes, I was hooked.
The show, City Hunter, a hit thriller about a man who's hunting down his father's killer.
I watched the whole 20 hours, marathoned it.
And she's been hooked since. It's all thanks to video streaming companies like Drama Fever, the largest distributor of Asian TV content in North America. It attracts millions of viewers here in the U.S., and most are non-Asian.
I think what we tapped into was a demand for foreign content, regardless of your ethnic background, a demand for foreign content that was something different, something exciting, something interesting that was not available.
Suk Park co-founded Drama Fever back in 2008. He was searching for Korean TV dramas to brush up on his own Korean language skills, but he quickly learned
most of the consumption was happening online through illegal sites.
That convinced Park to launch a legal site with subtitled content licensed from South Korean broadcasters. He now employs more than 60 people and runs sites in English and Spanish. Korean dramas have become so popular with Latinos. Drama Fever recently signed a deal with Hispanic broadcaster Telemundo.
참, 한성이 만났니? 너 온다고 걔가 집 다 치우고 고생했는데.
That's the Korean hit show Coffee Prince. It's a Cinderella story about a poor young woman who disguises herself as a boy to get work at a coffee shop. Then the rich store owner falls in love with him and then discovers he's a woman. Park calls it a K-drama classic.
You'll always have the really rich, sort of aloof male lead. And then you'll have the poor girl, as in a girl from a poor family, with a heart of gold.
There are also stories about aliens falling in love with humans, stories about revenge with hokey twists and turns, and they're all packaged for binge-watching.
It's one complete story, one season, and then you're out.
That's Sarah, who prefers to go by her online name Java Beans. She works full-time on a Korean drama superfan site called Drama Beans. Sarah grew up in California, watching Korean TV with her parents.
They were always on in my household. I've watched so many that I don't know the names of, that I barely remember the plots of. My parents would just have them on.
She says changing viewing habits and YouTube have fueled the genre's popularity here. Sarah and her co-writer Jen, who goes by her online handle Girl Friday, regularly host K-drama meetups in places like New York City and Seattle.
We had, you know, 60-something-year-old professors. We had 18-year-old college students, people who were like, I'm in high school. I can't come to this meetup at the bar. Can you meet me at the Starbucks?
American companies are taking note. Hulu's partnered with Drama Fever to offer more than 200 K-dramas on their site. Netflix is expanding its foreign content, too. But Park at Drama Fever isn't expecting to compete with Showtime or HBO. He has other goals.
Entertainment is a gateway to culture. Through the Korean dramas, you become familiar with Korean values, Korea as the country, Korean food, Korean customs.
And the shows are proving America's endless appetite for binge TV viewing goes beyond the English language. For The World, I'm Akiko Fujita, Los Angeles.
So are you taking advantage of Netflix or Hulu to stream K-dramas? Or have you gotten hooked on some other international shows? Join our online chat right now at PRI.org and add your thoughts. Or drop us a note on Twitter with the hashtag GlobalNation. This is The World on PRI. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're going to hear about a Canadian master of the short story who's not Alice Munro. But first, we have an update on a controversy we told you about yesterday. It's about the theme from HBO's Game of Thrones. One devoted fan complained that the song sounds like it was computer-generated.
The way I could probably describe it best is if you heard your favorite song as sung by your GPS machine.
That's Canadian violinist Lara St. John. She told us she especially objects to the artificial-sounding cello in the opening.
It's kind of like auto-tune. It gives credence to the fact that one might be able to replace live musicians with these computer-generated, horrific, supposed musical lines.
St. John went so far as to hire a live cellist and record her own version of the Game of Thrones theme. Well, HBO got back to us, and they say St. John is wrong. HBO maintains that the theme wasn't computer-generated and that they used a live cello for all of the recordings. Here's the official version from HBO. You decide. And you can hear Lara St. John's version at our website at PRI.org.
Thank you.
Finally today, there's Alice Munro and Margaret Atwood. And then there was Mavis Gallant. Gallant was the least well-known of these Canadian women of literature, but she was just as respected. Mavis Gallant died earlier this week at the age of 91. She'd been living in Paris for decades. Writer Daphne Calate is a scholar of Mavis Gallant's writings. She says Gallant had a hard time in her early years, and it was reflected in her stories.
She had sort of a miserable childhood. Her parents put her into a convent school, basically, when she was 4 years old. She was living apart from home. Her father died when she was 10. Her mother remarried, was really not interested in raising her. So I think she felt abandoned and never really got over that in a way.
And how did that experience inform her writing?
Well, on the one hand, I think she had a very generous view of children and how deeply they feel and experience the world. And she expressed that so beautifully. But I think it also made her more attuned to abandonment of all kinds and to the feeling of being uprooted from home, sent around to, you know, in her life, she was sent to so many boarding schools. And I think that's part of why she was able to capture the experience of so many people from World War II, war refugees, people having to escape. I think that she intuited what that experience was like.
Now, I know she was a newspaper reporter in Montreal in the late 40s, and then she finally decided, listen, I want to be a writer, I'm going to move to Paris. And it's there where she really found her literary voice. Do you see that in her writing, that the location of Paris and moving there really freed her to become a writer?
You know, she always said that, and it's possible that she needed that distance to be able to look back on her experience and turn it into art. I do personally prefer her stories that are set in France and actually in all of Europe, because she lived there among people who had their lives had been torn apart and they were restarting, often in middle age. She seemed to really to be able to reach into the souls of people who were starting over and after great trauma. And I feel like those stories are the ones that are, for me, richer and more deeply felt and more meaningful.
I mean, I've read her stories in The New Yorker for years and years, of course not in recent years because she's been old and ailing. But what's interesting is her first short story collection was published in the U.S. in 1956, but it would be more than 20 years before her books were published in Canada. Why did it take so long?
It's kind of insane, isn't it? And I think, you know, this is something that I think even Alice Munro sometimes portrays Canada this way, the sense of you're not supposed to show off, you're not supposed to shine. And this is an old-fashioned view of Canada, but this sort of restrictive world. And it was part of what Gallant was leaving, this feeling of you're a woman, you're not supposed to speak out, you're supposed to marry and have children. And she felt that's part of why she felt that she had to move to Paris. She also sometimes had a judgmental view of that lifestyle, the 1930s, 40s, 50s Canadian lifestyle. But the other thing that I actually find inspiring is that she never felt the need to hobnob with her literary circle. I know that she knew to some extent somebody like Margaret Atwood or Alice Munro, but she wasn't hanging out with writers in her country. And that could be part of it, too, that the publishing world there, that she wasn't on their radar.
Now, you met Mavis Gallant in Paris. So what led you to her?
I grew up reading her stories from being partly Canadian. So we had her stories in my house, and I sensed the depth and great sadness, I think, in her stories, as well as the humor. And then when I wanted to become a writer, I was studying her and thinking, I can really learn from her. I want to write like this. Her sentences are exquisite. Her humor is so real and even appropriate when she's writing about really tragic things. And to be able to do that, you know, I thought, this is what I aspire to. So I thought, wow, if I can do this as part of my schooling and get a degree for it, all the better.
What was she like?
It's interesting. I was terrified to meet her. I thought from her writing that she would be, you know, I knew she was incisive. I knew she could see into the souls of her characters. So could she see into my soul? And would she think, oh, no, this is a 26-year-old girl who's maybe not very smart? So I was so scared. And she was sitting there at this outdoor cafe, like so many of her characters who go to cafes in Paris. And she looked up when I came out of the metro stop. I remember I saw her and she looked exactly like her picture. And I waved and she waved back and she had this beautiful smile. And I thought, no, she's a human being and she's curious and inquisitive. And she wanted to meet me too, and I realized she probably saw me the way she had once been in her 20s when she was so curious and wanting to begin to write.
That's Daphne Calate sharing her memories of Canadian writer Mavis Gallant, who died on Tuesday. You can watch a short video of Daphne reading an excerpt from Gallant's short story, The Remission, at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.